You ready? Here's to the rogues, all those weirdos out there, writing their true stories, letting it all hang out. You know what this podcast is. It's like where all the carnies hang out. Make no mistake, we live on the edge, and we're a stumble. We're a nudge from taking the plunge, man, to the murky depths of the dead marshes, falling and feeling the weightlessness of free fall. Yeah, man, that's us. And maybe, during our turbulent descent, we'll hear the almighty riff pipe as we near the earth. What do you say, CNFers? Let's get after it. What is this, a poetry slam? I don't know. That's right. I'm Brendan O'Mara. Hey, hey. And this is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak to badass people about the art and craft of telling true stories. Today's guest is the Lily Danziger, whose new memoir, Negative Space, is out now. Great book. The detective story as she tries to uncover her late father and her late father's past, his struggles with addiction, and the disturbing, on-the-edge nature of the art he made, a kind of code he lived by. And I love codes. But let me say this first. Creative Nonfiction Podcast is brought to you by West Virginia Wesleyan College's Low Residency MFA in Creative Nonfiction. Whew. Now in its 10th year. We're in our 9th year. They're in their 10th. We're like practically the same age. This affordable program boasts a low student-to-faculty ratio and a strong sense of community. Recent CNF faculty include Randon Billings Noble, Jeremy Jones, and CNF Pod alum Sarah Einstein. Episode 11 or 12. I can never remember. Anyway, there's also fiction and poetry tracks. Recent faculty include Ashley Bryant Phillips and Jacinda Townsend, as well as Diane Gilliam and Savannah Sipple. No matter your discipline, if you're looking to up your craft or learn a new one, consider West Virginia Wesleyan. Right. Get that? See, hear that pun? Right. In the heart of Appalachia. Visit mfa.wvwc.edu for more information and dates of enrollment. And you know, keep the conversation going on social media at CNFpod. If you're feeling kind, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Those go a long way towards validating the enterprise. There's some social capital for the wayward CNFer who's just stumbling by the past. Maybe they're typing creative nonfiction into Apple's their search, and this one will come up, and they're like, oh, wow, look at all those reviews and ratings. I'm going to give that guy a shot. I've never heard of that guy, but he talks to some cool people. I'll give it a shot. And the more reviews there are, the better they'll land and the more likely they'll stay. Am I right? I don't know. Also, consider becoming a member on the Patreon page. I know I beat this drum to death, but I'm putting together the next issue of the Audio Mag. It's a crunch, let me tell you. It's going to come down to the wire. Issue 1 was free, Isolation, and will remain in the podcast feed indefinitely, but issue 2 and beyond are exclusive to the Patreon community. Patrons get lots of cool goodies, as well as the knowledge that they're supporting the writers and the CNFing community in the production of this show. You won't want to miss this one, CNFer, let me tell you. Summer, and it's right on our heels, baby. And from now until August, I plan on giving the loudest of shout-outs to Hippocamp 2021. It's back. Back, baby. Don't call it a comeback. In Lancaster, PA, registration is open. It's a conference for creative nonfiction writers. Marion Winnick will be this year's keynote speaker. I'll be delivering a podcast-themed talk. That's cool. I can't speak highly enough of this conference. August 13th through the 15th. You dig? And you've heard me say it, that if you want to get into shape, you hire a personal trainer. Listen, you know the fundamentals. You got to eat right and you exercise, but you hire a trainer to hold you accountable, to put you through the paces, and maybe to see things you can't see. So that's where I come in. I mean, not to like get you six-pack abs and big-ass arms, but if you're ready to level up your manuscript and your writing, I'd be honored to help and get you where you want to go with your book or your essay or maybe even your book proposal. Wherever it needs to go, I hope I can help you get you there. So email me and we'll start a dialogue. and we'll take it from there. All right, that's a lot of housekeeping, but it's got to happen. It just has to happen. I'm sorry. That's what the skip button is for, if you know I'm going to start riffing on housekeeping. But like I said, Lily Danziger is here. She's at Lily Danziger on Twitter. LILLYDANCYGER. We get into some stuff, man. You're going to want to hear how working with Lydia Yuknovich in a workshop in Portland helped her crack the code of the book she wrote, Negative Space, reframing networking, the icky feeling of networking as the more, I don't know.
Kind of reframing the idea of networking and thinking about it as community instead.
What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. Community building. It's better. There you go. There's a word. And a new way to think about branding. It's all here. And one final sponsor. This show is brought to you by the word Blunger. Blunger is a noun. It's a large container with rotating arms for mechanical mixing. It's also one who blunges. Blunger. Thank you, Blunger. Here's Lily, you CNF incarnies. What are you reading these days? What are you putting in the tank?
I'm currently reading White Magic, Alyssa Washuda's new collection. I'm really enjoying it so far. I'm only a couple essays in. It's a pretty substantial book, so I feel like I'll be reading it for a while. I'm kind of trying to read one at a time and digest them, you know, rather than speeding through the whole thing. But it's really cool and smart and intense with moments of humor, too. So, yeah, I enjoy it.
You alluded to how you've been going through a lot of the, you know, the book promotion stuff, and it's it can be, you've been at it for, I feel like you've been at it for a while. You've been putting out a lot of articles that that are, you know, heavily of the memoir and everything, and like you've built a really good sort of machine around it. So how did you develop the strategy of doing that and leaning into it like that?
You know, it's been a long time in the making. You know, I've been writing the book for over a decade, and for the last like 5 years or so, I've kind of had in mind setting myself up for a good launch, you know, and just getting to know as many people as possible so I can be invited on cool podcasts like this and be able to publish related essays and excerpts and read at reading series. And, you know, I think a lot about kind of reframing the idea of networking and thinking about it as community instead. And,
bingo.
You know, thinking about, because networking is kind of like a dirty word, right? It sounds like fake and schmoozy and like you're trying to use people, you know? And so I
transactional. I think about,
exactly. Yeah. And I focused instead on, you know, building genuine community, building relationships with people. And, you know, working as an editor and an instructor as well, I think is good, because then I'm not just taking as a writer who needs promotion for my work. You know, I'm also able to give other people a platform and help them with their work and invite people to read at my reading series. And, you know, it's more of a kind of give and take and supporting each other. And yeah, over the last several years, I've known that I was going to have this book out eventually, and that I was going to need to do a lot of work to get it out into the world. So I've been kind of getting ready for this period for a long time.
Yeah. And given that, you know, that the arts and writing and the whole, you know, community around it can be sometimes, you know, virulently competitive and toxically competitive and jealous. And, but you're saying and doing all the right things by, you know, reframing networking as community, and anyone who follows any of your, you know, social channels, it's just, yeah, you're celebrating people's work and building that community. So how did you arrive at that as an ethos instead of taking it sometimes down that toxic, you know, sewer, if you will?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it just grew out of like genuine excitement for my friend's success, you know, making friends with other writers and seeing them get the publications that are perfect for them and seeing, you know, celebrating their success. And of course I had pangs of jealousy along the way, you know, when I was trying to publish my book for so long and it wasn't happening and I kept seeing other people announce deals. Like, of course you're going to be a little covetous sometimes, right?
For sure.
But I just was, you know, I was aware and I was paying attention to my reactions and realizing that it just was so much more fun and healthy and productive and enjoyable to just to be happy for people instead, and, you know, to kind of train myself out of that scarcity mindset and remember that somebody else getting a book deal is not taking anything away from me, you know, if it's just putting more good work into the world, and hopefully I would get to join them soon, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it was a conscious reframing.
For sure. Exactly. It's such a great way to put it, because that's fuel that burns clean. And it isn't, you know, by you even citing the getting away from that scarcity mindset, like, it's truly not a zero sum game. Some people that I've had the privilege of speaking to, you know, they see it as like, oh, if Patrick Radden Keefe is publishing this, it means, oh, that's great. That's work that I can aspire to. Then I can do that too. Instead of like, oh shit, he did that, now I can't. And so it's that conscious reframing that it's actually abundant in there's really an opportunity there in seeing great work pave the road for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I just was having a conversation with somebody about this recently who, you know, has a book in the works and saw a book announced that was really similar to theirs. And they were feeling weird about it and, you know, wondering, is this a bad thing? And I was like, no, you know, it's a good thing. This is, you know, this is priming the world for your work. Now you have a comp title. You should go make friends with this person. Maybe they'll blurb you or do an event with you or whatever, you know, identifying people who are doing work similar to yours as allies rather than competition, I think makes this whole thing more enjoyable.
And since you do a lot of editing too, how do you balance, you know, editing people's work and also managing their expectation that even though they're working with you, you know, an incredibly skilled editor and writer, that you can't necessarily guarantee that their work will be published in, you know, their A or number one tier place. So how do you manage that and toggle, you know, while you're giving them the best coaching and guidance and counsel with the expectation that as good as this can be, it's still a subjective game?
Yeah. I mean, I think most people get that, you know, but I have a disclaimer on my website, just like, you know, just in case, just, you know, I'll give you my best feedback and advice, but yeah, it still is kind of a crapshoot. It depends on what mood the editor is in the day they get your submission, as much as it does on the quality of the work, you know, but I think, you know, I hope that people can tell that I'm giving them my best when I give them feedback, you know, and I'm being honest and being direct and being blunt and also encouraging, and, you know, I'm just helping them get their work as good as it can get. But then after that, it's up to the whims of the publishing gods.
Yeah, no kidding. It's weird. It's one of those things that I've struggled with of late, because if people are shelling out, like, you know, a lot of money to have, you know, someone skilled give them, you know, good guidance, good notes, good counsel, and you know, in a way, like a micro MFA of having that experience, it's like, you want to be able to say, like, I wish I could say that this thing will be published in McSweeney's, or you will land a book agent, or anything. And it's just, those things are so out of your control. So it's sometimes hard to, you know, take on that money, do that work. No, but their ultimate goal is still, it's not guaranteed. And that's something that I struggle with, that knowing that they can't, it's like, I wish I could guarantee that for you, so there's more of a payoff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I wish that too. I wish I could guarantee book deals for all my friends who deserve them, you know?
Yeah.
But so much of it, you know, nothing is guaranteed in this business. And so much of it is about taking that risk and doing a lot of work up front and then just hoping, you know? So I think we're all kind of used to that, I guess.
For sure. And to that point, like, as you're looking to crack the code of negative space, you know, you, you invested in yourself when you came across Lydia Yuknovich's workshop in Portland, where you're like, okay, this is something, you know, I'm going to bank some money. I'm going to book a trip. I'm going to head out there and work with her and a cohort of other people to kind of crack that code. So maybe you can walk us through into that experience for you and how that helped you forge what would ultimately become Negative Space.
Yeah, that was really formative. And I was so happy, and I feel so lucky to have discovered the community that she's created in Portland. You know, even though I'm across the country, I still feel really connected to that awesome space that Lydia's made. And, you know, I'm looking forward to going to another workshop as soon as like they're in person again and travel is safe and all that. But yeah, I was far enough along in the process by that point when I read her book and then discovered that she led workshops also, that I knew I was going to put everything I had into it. You know, there was no question for me of whether it was worth it. When I took that workshop, I went to the Tin House workshop, which I crowdfunded for, because that was, you know, more expensive and a longer trip and all of that. And I was still scraping by freelancing and bartending. So, you know, of course it's hard. You have to balance. Just because something is worth the expense doesn't mean you can afford it. But I always kind of, I have a hard time feeling guilty about spending money and time investing in my craft. You know, I buy too many books and I don't feel bad about it. I take workshops whenever I find one that looks exciting. I go to all the conferences. You know, that just feels like something that's really worth the time and money and effort to me.
Yeah, and you write about, you know, being in Lydia's workshop, that she said that there are a handful of core metaphors, you know, in their life, in their writing, that can always return to for new meaning, symbols that reverberate deep within us as an endless well of inspiration and material. And maybe you can, you know, take us to, you know, that moment that seems like it was a real crack of lightning for you.
It was, yeah, because, you know, it was, I guess like so many moments in the process that ended up being revelatory, it felt kind of distressing at first when she was saying that. And I was trying to think about like, okay, what are my core metaphors? And I was feeling like I don't have any, and that I had just been working with my father's metaphors. And I was having this little existential crisis sitting in the middle of this writing workshop, like, oh, have I, you know, neglected to create my own creative identity because I've just been so focused on writing about my father's creative life and his work, realizing that those two things were not canceling each other out, but that in fact I had been forging my own creative identity through the process of writing about his work. It made a final piece of the puzzle kind of click together about what the project even was, you know, and helped connect the artist monograph research aspect with the memoir aspect in a more kind of holistic way than they had been connected before.
And you also write that over the course of the genesis of the book, that you read one memoir after another, and maybe which ones stand out to you that helped you the most in being a model for what you would write?
Yeah, there were a few, and I kind of think about them in this. They came to me at different parts of the process and helped me unlock different aspects of what I was trying to do. And the first one, which was really, really formative for me, was The Night of the Gun by David Carr. And I read that pretty early in the process, and that was an early model for me of how to kind of include reporting in a journalistic approach in memoir, which I had kind of already been trying to do without really understanding what I was doing. So seeing him do it in such a masterful way made me realize like, okay, this really can be a book. And then later when it started to shift and it kind of expand beyond that journalistic mode, even though that kind of still stayed at the core of it, then obviously Lydia Yuknovich's Chronology of Water was big for the book itself and also for the fact that it led me to that workshop. Toward the end of the process, I read T. Kira Madden's Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls and Sophia Shalmayev's Mother Winter. And I read those both in the same summer when I was puzzling through structure. And something about, you know, seeing the two of those next to each other and how they both handle a complicated story with unique structure and kind of invent their own style of storytelling and don't, you know, try and hem it into one narrow idea of what a structure can be and kind of create their own structure. That really shook something loose for me at the end of the process that allowed me to find the structure that Negative Space wanted to fit into.
Yeah, and what struck me about the book too was that repertorial detective sort of, mode of information gathering that is sort of very much folded into it. And I really like that, how you were just really on the hunt for something. And that's kind of a theme that comes up too, of addiction too, of the hunter and the hunted, and mm-hmm. and how those sort of are one in the same, especially in especially in terms of addiction. And I love that element of it too, of just, you were just really on the hunt in this story. And that came through nice. And it was a great sort of like journey to be on with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, I landed on that as a way to give stakes to the story for a reader, right? Where like the emotional stakes of figuring out my father and, you know, what made him tick and what he thought about and who he was, you know, those are inherent for me as his daughter. But I early on was coming up against, you know, how do I make a reader who never met this person care? But everybody loves a detective story, so.
I was amazed at your capacity to probe and interview the people closest to you and the people closest to your father. I imagine it was very uncomfortable at times, but maybe you can just tell us what that experience was like interviewing those close to your father and even your mother.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable at times, but it also it gave me a safe framework in which to have these conversations that I think would have been a lot more uncomfortable without that kind of excuse of an interview. You know, if you just have these hard conversations just as two people talking to each other, there are so many ways it can go off the rails and, you know, become an argument or become driven by emotion. But the fact that I was, like you said, in search of something, you know, I was having these conversations with a purpose. I was there to get information, but that kind of allowed it to stay focused and contained in a way that I think was really useful. But yeah, there definitely were times when when I was like, well, okay, what have I gotten myself into here? You know, wading into choppy waters, talking about things that I don't really want to talk about and I don't really want to know about.
Yeah.
But I also, I guess, understood that the more uncomfortable I was in the conversation, the more likely it was that I was getting something really good and interesting for the story.
Yeah, you write about having to essentially navigate, you know, the mother-daughter context too, and try to step out of that in order to, you know, gain or glean the information that you wanted. And I imagine that must have just been really hard, especially as you're getting into really sensitive matters where whether it is, you know, drug use or sex, you know, mm-hmm. it's really uncomfortable for a child to talk to the parent about those things. It's awkward and it feels invasive and you just kind of want to put on the blinders, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that line, of course, is blurred. As much as I was approaching it as a journalist, it still is, you know, it obviously still is within the mother-daughter context too. But I think that was one benefit of the fact that the project took so long, you know, is that we didn't dive right into the hardest stuff right away. We took our time and we had these conversations over a period of several years. And so that allowed us to both kind of acclimate a little more along the way to having these very candid conversations.
That's a really, really good point that you make, because it's like the scuba diving metaphor. If, you know, if you come up too
right.
fast, you're going to
yeah.
get the bend.
Yeah.
The fact that this was like a pretty almost a 10-year project, it's like you could dive in and dive out or just take your time coming up to the surface or going below, whatever, choose your metaphor. But when you read the book and you read it over the course of 3 or 4 days, you're like, oh my God, how'd this happen? But to your point, it took 10 years. So
right.
you could tiptoe around things and then say like, okay, let's mentally prepare for a hard conversation.
Exactly. And, you know, take breaks and take time away and take some time in between to just be people would have been harder if I'd been, you know, on a tight deadline and I had to try and do this all in a year or something. I don't think it would have worked out in the same way.
And so you started this book roughly 10 years ago, and that would have been, you know, roughly, you know, 10 years after your father passed away. And now it's mm-hmm. 10 years later, 20 years removed from yeah. from your dad passing away. So, you know, what's what have you noticed the difference between just with yourself from, you know, 10 years ago when you started this and 10 years later having finished this?
I mean, just about everything. You know, it was actually a little more than 10 years. So it was right at the beginning of my 20s. I was just becoming an adult. I was still in college. I was, you know, I mean, at this point, I look back at that version of myself and I'm even more removed from that than I was from, you know, the angry teenage punk version of myself at the point where I first started the project, you know? And yeah, it's weird having so much time pass within the creation of a project because there are so many different perspectives embedded in it, you know, and I had to kind of try to smooth them out so that it still felt like it was written by one person and not like some passages were written by a 20-year-old and some were written by a 30-year-old. So, that, you know, that took a lot of rewriting. But my, you know, my perspective on the story and on the characters and on myself and on what the project was and on memoir in general and myself as a writer, you know, all of that is completely different than it was when I started.
Yeah, that's a great point you're making too about trying to make it seem like it is of one writer, even if it's the same person, you're a different writer than you were 10 years yeah. ago than you are today. And similarly, just I've been, you know, I'm in the throes of a 10 to an 11 year memoir as well. Mm. And over the course of the several rewrites, it's just like, okay, that was the 30-year-old, you know, 29, 30-year-old who wrote the early drafts. And then the later drafts, which are competent, you know, it's by a 39 to 40-year-old. It's like, there's a big gap there. I read a lot of things. I got into, I'm sorry to admit, the David Foster Wallace phase that I think every 30-year-old male goes through. And I'm like, gotta get that out of there. So you just find that you can tell who you're imitating at a certain time at a various point in the drafting process. And you're like,
oh,
right,
yeah,
I gotta smooth this out.
For sure. Yeah. My early drafts. Well, I mean, yeah, mentioning, you know, the cycles of the books that I read at different points, you know, and early drafts were very much me trying to be like a 20-year-old girl version of David Carr. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and then you can tell which draft I wrote right after reading Chronology of Water, you know, but then you go back later and you're like, okay, that's me trying to try on somebody else's style. And you have to kind of synthesize and digest all the different things enough that those, fingerprints aren't quite as visible, you know, and it all becomes integrated into your own style, which takes time. And I think finding, you know, we talk about voice. I think that's what that means, right? Is finding the way to sound like yourself and not sound like yourself trying to sound like somebody else.
For sure. Have you, at this point in your journey as a writer, do you feel like you've really settled on what is, you know, your particularly unique voice synthesized from all these influences?
That's an interesting question. I mean, to an extent, yes, but I also continually, you know, try and push myself and try different things and try different styles. And I think, you know, of course your voice is going to sound a little different doing different kinds of things, but I can tell at this point when I don't sound like myself, you know, which mm-hmm. is good. I can, you know, I can go back and read a draft and I can tell that I was like trying too hard or putting something on or, you know, I don't know, being overly influenced by whatever I just read. And I can catch that more quickly, I think, than I used to be able to, which I guess means by deductive reasoning that I have a clearer idea of what my actual authentic voice is.
And I believe that, you know, early on people were advising you, or maybe someone wanted to publish your book but didn't want the imagery of your father's art in it. And that was very important for you to have that imagery as part of this book. And I think it really informs it, and it packages so well together to have that. So, how maybe you can speak to that, the importance of having your father's art and his fingerprints in that sense all over this book from cover to cover.
Yeah. That was just well-meaning advice, which, I think was true. I probably could have published this a long time ago if I just made it a straightforward memoir, but that just was not the book I was interested in writing. The art was the original impetus for the project to begin with. That was where I started thinking about my father's story, and the art was where I started asking questions and piecing things together. And it really remained the core of the thing, despite the many different iterations that the rest of the project took, and the journalistic elements, and then the memoir elements, and finding the balance between those. As much as I was going back and forth on that scale, the art was always the heart of it. And it was what the rest of the story was organized around. And so it just was never an option to me to not have it in there. And luckily I'm, stubborn enough that I was never even really tempted by that idea. It always was just, it's going to be this book with the art, or it's not going to be a book at all.
Well, you definitely get that from your father. That's like kind of a core ethos of him. He's a very stick to his guns kind of an artist.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's part of it too. The fact that I always thought of this as not just my book. It's my book and my father's book. It's the book of his art. So I very much had his voice in my head, even more than I would normally. I could see just so clearly how hurt and offended and disappointed he would be if I started this project with his art and then was like, never mind, I'm going to take the images out. Like, what an insult. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, you're right too. This is just the other side of that, the stubbornness that's worth unpacking, is that that you wrote, I've tried to learn from his self-sabotage to balance the idea of writing that exists only for itself with the need to play by at least some of the rules if I wanted to build a career. So there's that sort of other side of that coin of sticking to your guns and then playing by the rules of everybody else if you want to sustain yourself doing this.
Yeah. And that's something I think about a lot. And it kind of, I guess, goes back to where we started this conversation with thinking about networking versus community. And, I think there's so much kind of grossness attached to the buzzwords like platform and brand and all of that, and I don't like that. I am not a brand, but I do understand the value of becoming visible in the community and in the field in which you are working, and I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that consciously and, thinking strategically about how to position yourself and your work and how to make the connections that will help you get your work out into the world with as much, juice behind it as possible. And I think I've found a good balance and a good way for me to do that authentically, which is, goes back to that idea of building community rather than building a network.
For sure. And, whenever I think of how gross, brand is, and I'm totally in agreement with that, it is gross in the whole platform thing. But there are ways where someone like the great Seth Godin rephrases items of that or topics of that nature, where in terms of brand thinking, it's like Nike isn't in the business of hotels, but if Nike built a hotel, you would know it. And that's
right.
Brand. And so you would see the swoosh and images of Steve Prefontaine and all the athletes. You'd be like, that's a Nike hotel. And so I think the body of work that you're putting together, like the body of work is the best brand there is, whether it's, Burn It Down or this memoir. It's like, oh, that is the Lily Danziger, sort of stamp, call it a brand, but it's just your body of works, vouching for you.
Yeah, I like that way of thinking about it. And yeah, the body of work is the most important piece of it all. I think that's something that definitely gets lost sometimes in the fixation on, brand and platform and whatever, is it becomes, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, right? It becomes more the buzz than the substance. And I think it can be easy to lose sight of why you're doing all of that to begin with, right? You're not doing all that just for the sake of retweets, right? It's you're trying to become visible so that people will read your work. And it's all in service of the work, and therefore the work still has to come first. And yeah, it has to be authentic to you. And I've thought a lot about, you know, how what I put out in the world reflects on me as a writer. And that's why I stopped the kind of freelance hustle that I was in for a while of just trying to publish as much as possible and trying to have my name out there constantly and get the bylines and trying to support myself by freelance writing, which means constant grind. But I realized that in doing that, I was putting out a bunch of work that was not representative of me and how I want to be seen as a writer. And so I made a very conscious switch to focus on quality over quantity. You know, now I publish a lot less than I used to, but I feel really good about everything that I put out in the world.
Yeah, like to that point, like you were able to take something like, you know, an essay about the Queen's Gambit and reflect it back on the toxic myth of the drug-addled artist or the drug-subsidized
genius.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a way, and how, what a toxic story that is and a toxic myth that is. And you were able to reflect it back on, you know, on your father and your parents, how they were, you know, they were addicted and it did not serve, you know, did not serve their art and, you know, their place in the world. So it's like, there's a great example of, you know, you being able to put your stamp on something that you really believe in and reflects back on, you know, the book you wrote.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, it had been a while since I published a hot take about a TV show, you know, but I waited until there was something that I actually had something to say, you know, not just like, oh, I should come up with an idea about whatever trending topic is at the top of the Google algorithm today.
Right. And I love there's a moment in the book too, where you write that, you know, using art as a spell to raise the dead. And I love that moment too. I love that turn of phrase, and I love what that symbolizes. And it harkens back to the way your father would use, you know, roadkill or, you know, a dead bird and elements of feathers and skeletons to form his sculptures and all the kinds of statues sculptures he would make. And it was just a way of repurposing, a way of art to kind of reflect, you know, the passing of time and the passing of life. And was that something that was kind of always at the, you know, a North Star for you in a sense over the course of this book?
No, I don't think I knew. I don't think I really understood at the beginning what I was really doing, you know, and the scope of the project or how much it was in conversation with his work. You know, that was one of the really cool and weird and kind of disorienting and exciting things to discover along the way through this process, was realizing that I was not just writing about his work, but I was really in conversation with it and responding to it as an artist on my own, you know, on my own 2 feet, not just like reflecting back his. So yeah, that was something I didn't really make that connection until I was already, you know, until I had already waded pretty far out into the project. But it was really, it was cool to realize, and it felt like a bit of serendipity that made me feel like I was doing something right. You know?
Yeah. And of course, you know, you chronicle how, you know, you drop out of high school and you go, you know, you go through, you work your way through, you have a very, you know, textured teenage years where you're, you know, living with several roommates and you're almost, you know, you're a very intimate aunt essentially to your friend and her baby Riley at the time. And, you know, of course, you know, you're working through all this and you eventually, you know, get into college, and then you write when you get into Columbia that you've been seduced by prestige. And I love that notion of how you refer to the subversion of the dropping out of school and the getting into Columbia as acts of rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it wasn't expected of you.
Exactly. Yeah. Both were, you know, it's got to keep people on their toes. looking back, you know, what might be expected would be that you would think the dropping out of high school was the low point and getting into Ivy League grad school was the high point. But for me, it was the opposite when I look back. You know, I think dropping out of high school was a ballsy move that I'm like proud of myself for making. And that was authentic to what I felt and needed at the time in my life, you know, and who I was and being aware of what I needed at an age when not everybody does. And then through, you know, over the years, I felt self-conscious about that, you know, and I felt like it was a mark against me and I felt like I had to compensate for it. And so I went to Columbia to prove myself. And I only realized after the fact that I didn't need to prove myself to anybody. You know, I am who I am and it's fine. And that ended up being a very expensive lesson. You know, now I'm in debt forever.
Right. We kind of referred to it already about the hunter and hunted, but you write that, you know, addiction is a hunter contained within the hunted, an enemy you can't run from because it lives inside you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's of course something that your parents wrestled with. And I think you were probably on the verge of that, especially on mm-hmm. as a teenager. So, addiction can run down the DNA. So, how important was it for you to talk about addiction in these kind of terms to maybe demystify it and maybe empathize with it?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I kept coming up against societal notions of addiction, you know, and I tried not to think too much about the stereotypes and the expected ideas, you know, and I tried to just find an authentic way to talk about my experience of growing up with addiction around me and you know, my own experience brushing up against it myself as a teenager. I kept, whenever I thought too much about addiction as a topic, right, and as a social issue, I felt myself slipping into this false, cheesy voice, you know, and this advocate speak and this moralizing, which I really wanted to avoid. You know, I'm not trying to teach anybody a lesson. I'm not trying to change the conversation. You know, I just wanted to tell a true and complicated story.
Yeah, that comes across, you know, really, really well. Like, of course, it's not preachy or anything. You just kind of like lay it out there that mm-hmm. this is something that happens to people and doesn't mean, you know, people are weak. They're just, it happens. And how do you live with it and dance with it and succumb to it and defeat it? It's all woven into this thing that you, this sort of tapestry that you put together. It was like a real, just great illustration of it without, you know, like you said, like moralizing the
right
and coming on from on high about the whole thing.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, back to that idea of needing to prove yourself, right? Like, I didn't need to prove to anybody that, you know, my parents had more to them than addiction. You know, I didn't need to compensate for that. I just wanted it to be apparent.
Yeah. And you also write too that, as you know, the bittersweet part of this project was you probably got to know your father better as a result of this, you know, mm-hmm. even if like, or if he were alive, you probably wouldn't know him as well as you got to know him through writing this book. And I thought that was just such an interesting thing to note, that and how bittersweet that is, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I've thought about that a lot, you know, especially now that it's finally out. And, you know, it was recently in the Strand bookstore, which is a big deal for me. And, you know, I was thinking about my father a lot because he really loved that bookstore, and thinking about how proud and excited he would be. Except that, of course, you know, if he was here, I probably wouldn't have written this book. And I probably would be a completely different person in so many ways that it's impossible to know. You know, and I think that's one of the most kind of complicated and hard things about grief, right, is understanding that as you live with it, it becomes such a factor in the development of your identity that, you know, no matter how much you might wish for that person to still be here, it's like going back in time and killing a butterfly, right? You have no idea what else about your life would change.
And, you know, you've zipped across the country a bunch of times when you were growing up, but you're, you know, always a New Yorker at heart. And you know, the book really bleeds that. And you're very proud of being a New Yorker. And it's so I wonder, like, you know, how much of a city, of the city is in your identity, and, you know, how you are so inextricably tied to New York.
Oh, so much. It's baked in, you know. And I really wanted it to be a very New York book too, you know, and I questioned at certain points, you know, some places that I reference, you know, I wondered, do I need to explain what this is? And I was like, no, you know, the people who know will know, you know, and that's
yeah.
I'm writing for myself. And so I'm writing for an audience who will get it. And if you don't know and you want to look up what Arlene's Grocery is, you can, you know. But yeah, it's very much, you know, part of who I am. And I think having left and crucial parts of my childhood, you know, just made me love the city even more. It made me so aware of how much happier I am here than anywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of like those touchstones or regional touchstones, I know what I'm writing too. It's just, you know, when I've grown up in southeastern Massachusetts and, you know, in New England in particular, or New England and then southeastern Mass in particular, it's like when I talk about, you know, ice skating on cranberry bogs or had like everybody in their cupboard has like the faded 33 inning Pawtucket Red Sox game cup like in their yeah. cupboard. Like, it's just, that means nothing to a lot of people, but it means everything to the people who grew up in that area. And it's like one of those little things. It's like, oh, okay, that is exactly. A very specific detail of a time and a place.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that makes it feel real and recognizable. And I wanted the people who were there at the time to see those references and have it add that context for them, and, you know, be a nod to the people who lived in the neighborhood.
You know, as we kind of bring this to a close, I always like asking a guest for a recommendation of some kind. And I wonder what recommendation might you pull out of your hat for the listeners?
I think something I've been thinking about a lot as everything becomes more and more digital is how much I value my paper notebooks. And so I think that's what I would recommend, is just getting a big pack of a cheap notebook that you like, not the fancy leather bound one, but just like a stack of bound paper, and try and do some of your writing and thinking there and get away from the computer. That's the best way that I have found to not be distracted by social media, is to do my first draft by hand. That's my recommendation.
Fantastic. Paper notebooks. I love it. You're talking to the right guy. I have myriad paper notebooks. So awesome. Well, Lily, and also one more thing, where can people, you know, find you online and get more familiar with your work so they can, you know, pick up the book and just like see what you're up to?
Yeah, you can find me at lilydanziger.com. And also on Twitter. That's where I spend most of my time online. I'm just at Lily Danziger.
Fantastic. Well, the book's incredible. Congratulations on it. And, you know, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking shop and talking negative space. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for reading and asking good questions. Appreciate it.
Out of breath. You ever get out of breath when you're reading a script and you're talking? I get out of breath all the time. I guess I don't know how to breathe from my diaphragm or whatever. My breath is probably stuck somewhere, and it's not working. When I was at a Godsmack concert, one of the several times I've seen Godsmack, and he's trying to get the crowd to sing Voodoo with him, he would just be like, "Sing from your gut, everybody. Fuck, sing from your gut." And I'm just like, all right, I gotta sing from my gut. And I'm not talking from my gut. Where did this come from? I don't know. Probably because I'm wheezing somewhat over here. Hey, wasn't that a toe-tapping good time with Lindsay, with Lily? I mean, I dig it. Hope you dig it too. You know, thank you, Lily, for the work, for the book, for being true to your work, sticking to your guns. And thanks to West Virginia Wesleyan College's MFA in Creative Writing and to HippoCamp 2021 for the support. And a shout-out to Blunger. What a word. I'm going to keep beating that Patreon drum because that's what's going to take this show to the next level. We're on a decent level, but we're always looking for the next level. Having the show be listener-supported gives you ownership. It gives you agency. Helps pay writers. Helps me make a better product. Helps me celebrate more CNFers and build the community. And it's not like you get nothing in exchange for a few bucks a month. There's all kinds of tiers there. Go and window shop. Maybe come into the store and handle a few things in your hand. And, you know, you might just walk away with something you really like. Patreon.com/CNFpod. I've been playing way too much online chess lately. Just chess.com. Real clever. I play against a beginner robot because I don't have the guts to play a human yet. It's really addicting, but it sure beats drinking myself in the blackout mode. I don't know what I'm doing. I know how the pieces move. I don't know how to do the king-rook switch yet. I know that's a thing, but I don't do it. I don't know how to do it. But that's it. I need to pay more attention because I can get all kinds of sloppy. And thanks to it being a beginner robot, he or she or it goes easy on me sometimes when it should take my queen when it could. And speaking of chess, I'm sure many of you have watched The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Great series. But I'd urge you to listen to the soundtrack on Spotify. The score by Carlos Rafael Rivera is brilliant. It's ethereal and emotive. Sad and moving and intense. It just gets into my bones, man. I've been listening to it on almost a nonstop loop the past few days. When I was writing this very script, I was listening to it. It helps me get into the mode. When the soundtrack comes on, it's like, all right, we're getting after it. Beautiful stuff. I reached out to Carlos's people, and he'll be on the show later in the summer. I want to talk to him about how music tells a story. And it's not nonfiction per se, but it's my show and I'll do what I want. Oh, see, I'm out of breath. Hold on, I gotta yawn. God damn it. From your gut, Sully. From your gut. One other thing I wanted to add. So I emailed a popular producer from This American Life, not Ira, a long time ago to come on the show. I actually did email Ira's people too, but I haven't heard back. Anyway, This particular woman, she didn't want to come on the show because she's kind of private and doesn't want to do that kind of thing, and that's totally cool. I get it. But she's really nice about it. And but I reached back out to her and asked a few weeks ago about some logistics about crafting narrative audio. It's kind of what I'm doing for some other clients, and it's a little outside of my purview. I get how to do it for print, like I'm structuring a story, but, you know, and that's hard enough as is, but then you're dealing with tape, and it's kind of a different ballgame about how you, curate your tape and edit your tape. You know, it's weird. I know how to massage it in print. It's very easy in terms of putting it in the manuscript and, you know, the way you kind of massage quotes to make them read better. It's a little different with audio. And I'm self-taught. So she gave me some really great tips, and I decided to send her a Starbucks gift card, digital one. Because basically we had a coffee date over email, and where she gave me some great pointers and took a lot of time out of her day, no doubt, to answer my questions. And I'm not saying this to toot my own horn. That's not what I'm getting at. But if you email someone you admire, someone who is prominent and skilled and is taking lots of their time to answer an email, give you advice, treat it like a coffee date. You know, throw them a $5 or $10 gift card, just what it would cost to have the coffee date. You don't have to, you know, break the bank. But, freaking Hank, hold on.
Get out of here. Get out.
So my dog was freaking out because Melanie just got back from PT. Anyway, where was I? All right, I've heard Jenny Gritters and Wudan Yan from the Writers Co-op podcast talk about this, and they've been guests on the show, and that both of them are going to come on soon because they have a new season of their podcast, so we're just going to have a little shindig. And I've heard them talk about that. You know, I think it shows an extra level of courtesy for someone to share their time and expertise with you. I mean, give it a shot. It feels kind of good. You know, and that's going to do it, CNFers. I'm very distracted since Hank started freaking out, and now I'm a little off my game. But at least I'm at the end of my script, and I'm gonna put a bow on this sucker. So, anyway, stay cool, CNFers. Stay cool forever. See ya!